The Wesendonck-Lieder by Wagner, Christa Ludwig was the soloist, and Otto Klemperer conducted the Philharmonia Orchestra. Well, next Sunday, the day before what would have been her 70th birthday, I'll be playing music performed by the cellist Jacqueline Dupré. And I'm going to end the programme with her classic recording with Barbarolli of the Elgar Cello Concerto. If you ever heard Dupré live or have any special memories of her, do drop me a line, sundaymorning@bbc.co.uk. I'd love some first-hand experience of her artistry taken from us far too soon. And of course, with 3 hours on my hands, there'll be plenty of other music too, including an hour's worth on the theme of flight. I'm James Jolly, and I hope you've enjoyed this morning's music. I've certainly had fun choosing it and look forward to your company same time next week. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
I was with Warhol for an hour and he said nothing.
Andy Warhol's New York factory was a magnet for artists.
Drew everyone to him, bang.
The Sunday feature presents Andy Warhol's factory friends.
Probably the vast majority were talent-free.
A creative hub.
It was called the factory for a reason. It wasn't called the party.
A social melting pot.
He was attracted to crazy people.
A workplace and a dive.
Primarily it was Andy's workplace.
I go to work and paint.
50 years since the factory opened, Paul Morley is on a quest to find out what happened to the extraordinary array of characters who lived, worked and partied there.
Ties and jackets. People think that, you know, Andy and craziness. We dress like this.
Andy Warhol's factory friends.
Warhol's words, it was,
I don't know.
This evening at 6:45 and for 30 days online, BBC Radio 3. On air, online, on when you want.
Oh, really? Oh.
And now it's time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the classics professor, Paul Cartledge.
If you want to know how to wield a Spartan spear, or whether Athens really was the cradle of democracy, or indeed what ancient Greek music might have sounded like, then Paul Cartledge is the man to go to. He's probably done more than anyone else in the past 3 decades to advance knowledge of ancient Greek culture, both in academic circles and in the public arena. He was, until very recently, the first A.G. Leventis Professor of Greek Culture at Cambridge, a chair founded to study 1,000 years of Greek cultural achievements and to highlight their lasting influence on society today. So, Paul, why do we study ancient history in the 21st century, and how is it relevant to us?
We study it for 2 reasons. One is to find out how it was, and the other is to find out how we can live our lives better as a result of studying the ancient Greeks. I specialise in the ancient Greeks, but I do the Romans as well. And I should add that but for the Romans, where would the Greeks be? In other words, the Romans decided that the Greeks were their intellectual ancestors, and they therefore chose to preserve, as well as to try to imitate or better, ancient Greek cultural forms, in particular poetry and other forms of literature.
Your other passion, of course, which is why you're here, is music. And I think you go to live music pretty much every week, don't you?
Well, it looks like it, pretty much. So, ballet, opera. Of course, in Cambridge, I'm surrounded, both in my college and in other university forums. There's something you can go to pretty much every day in term, and out of term, there's an awful lot of stuff also. So, yes, I'm surrounded by music.
And did this start when you were a child? I mean, did you have a good voice? Did you sing as a treble?
Yes, indeed. I was in, for example, a church choir from a young age, and I sang in my school's choir, and I was actually a soloist as a treble. And one reason why I've chosen one of the items is that I was actually a soloist, wasn't written for a treble, but I was a soloist in the Brahms German Requiem. So I had a fairly good treble voice and an appalling, broken, I suppose, tenor voice. So in terms of performance, I never learned music. I've never had a musical lesson. I can't read music, and the technicalities of music escape me. But I am, as I get older, more and more passionate about music, listening to music and experiencing it, sharing it.
This is one of the most famous bits in the German Requiem. has such an extraordinary literary line, doesn't it? All flesh is grass.
Yeah.
Such a wonderful thought, that.
Well, it's a wonderful thought, but it's also meant to be sobering because, of course, it means we wither and we faint and we die and so on. And Brahms, interestingly, chose not to use any Catholic, Roman Catholic version of the Bible, but particularly the German Lutheran, so Reformation version. And I tend to think, looking globally, that there's a kind of line of descent intellectually where I'd like to be a part of. And so we go back to the ancient Greeks through the Romans, the Reformation, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, and ultimately to me. So this is an important point on the journey.
And of course, none of them, all of the schools of thought that you've mentioned and indeed us, can deny the principle of dust to dust.
Yes, quite. Though I would take hope from the fact that the whole Requiem begins and ends with the same word, Selig, which means blessed, and I myself feel that I've had a very blessed life.
Thank you.
For all flesh is as grass, from Brahms' German Requiem, John Elliot Gardner conducting the Monteverdi Choir and the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique. I wonder why some people have such a specific antipathy towards Brahms. Britain famously.
Yes, I love a lot of Brahms. I wouldn't say all of Brahms. And I imagine Britain's distaste. He was a very fastidious man, and he probably thought Brahms was self-indulgent. I may be quite wrong about that.
Yes, but, I mean, he liked Tchaikovsky very much.
I too, yeah. And was it to all of Brahms' music, or particularly the choral, or particularly the instrumental?
I think it was Brahms full stop on the whole, and sometimes he even put it back on to remind himself that he didn't like it, which seems almost perverse.
Yes.
Did your love of music, as you said, started from an early age. Did your obsession with the ancient world start then as well?
It did, from the age of 8, and I can swear this. I knew that I wanted to be a historian, and I thought that probably distant rather than contemporary history. I was interested in Anglo-Saxon England, for example, from a young age. I've always been passionate about languages, and then the development of my academic interest is through history, through then archaeology, and then through archaeology to cultural history, which is pretty much where I am. But I do go, way, way back. I'm not an opsimath, as the Greeks would put it.
Yeah. Why do you think the teaching of Latin and Greek in schools, especially state schools, has declined so much? And is that something to be lamented?
Well, it declined historically because anything ancient in a modernizing society was deemed to be terrible. And secondly, it came with the stigma of being associated with what we call public schools, in fact, private schools. And so after the Second World War, there was a great democratizing movement. And it's still the case that Greek is hardly taught in any state school whatsoever, ancient Greek. However, I am a patron and an active member of a charity recently founded called Classics for All to promote the introduction of classics in the form typically of Latin in primary and secondary schools. And there is actually, quite surprisingly, a recrudescence of the teaching of Latin in schools, in particular in the maintained sector.
Presumably you'd argue that, as with music, that rather than being elitist, it's enabling.
Yes, I mean, I am an elitist in the sense that I actually prefer to hear and see the finest actors and musicians. I've myself nothing against elite. I love the Olympics, who are
well,
called
of course,
now.
Greek. Yeah.
They're again a Greek in origin, but they're called elite athletes, and we fund them publicly, and we think that's okay to fund elite athletes.
But I've never understood the kind of desire to remove elitism. Elitism is inescapable, isn't it?
I think it's the word that is unfortunate. Yeah. In other words, you add ism and then it's a bad thing and it's negative. So I am an elitist in a, if you like, morally neutral sense that I believe in excellence, but I believe that people who are gifted and talented and are enabled to develop their skills and talents to the maximum should then have a positive effect, bringing up or either entertaining or amusing or stimulating the majority. There shouldn't, in other words, be a cultural barrier. And one of the reasons I love the ancient Greeks, in particular the ancient Athenians, that what you and I might think to be an elite art form, tragedy, was actually what they would have called a popular art form, because the masses went to it and the masses decided which were the best plays, playwrights, actors. It was a democratic art form in origin. It's only culturally that it's received in an elite, or if you might like to say, elitist milieu.
I know you're a Cambridge man now, as it were, but the next music takes you back to your student days at Oxford in the 60s, doesn't it?
It does indeed. In the mid-60s, there were record companies, this is vinyl days, who pushed out extremely cheap versions, really brilliant performers in accessible forms. And I would go into a record shop and I'll say, I'll give this a try. So I came out one day with 4 out of the 6 cello suites. My interest in music goes earlier than Bach. Nevertheless, these suites appeal to me. I'm quite austere in my taste. So the fact that there's just a single instrument, that appealed to me. And Janosch Starker conjures up a sound world which is just so full of colour. Lovely. If I could just say, I'm a particular fan of Janosch Starker, who had a very difficult youth in the Second World War, but he had a prodigious childhood. He was a child prodigy. But thanks to YouTube, you can now watch him giving a masterclass, and it's quite an experience. Like me, or at least I like to think I'm a pedagogue, I've always been devoted to teaching, and Starker, by all accounts, was one of the most brilliant cello teachers.
He's recorded the Bach cello suites, I think, about five times.
It is, yes.
That one came from 1992. That's in the slightly tricky key for a cello of E-flat major. That was the Courant from suite number 4. Something you said just now, Paul Carthage, interested me in that you said how you have a sentimental attachment to that recording because it was the one that introduced you to the music.
Yeah.
And that interests me from the point of view of the brain and whether we do, in fact, always think that the first one we hear is the best performance.
Well, it's true of all but, I think, one of my choices for this programme. In other words, I am choosing either the artist or the actual recording that I first heard. So, yes, it seems to go deep, doesn't it? And it's said that when you fall in love first with another person, that can have similar effects. I'm sure that's true.
I mentioned Oxford, and, of course, you spent some time in Santa Barbara, too, in California in 1965,
yeah,
didn't you?
Because I first went to the States, as you say, as a student at the University of California in Santa Barbara, at the very height or depth, if you like, of the civil rights movement in the mid-60s with murders and all sorts of things going on, lynchings, absolutely appalling. And Bob Dylan, whose voice I first heard, 1965, I was, I suppose, a bit slow because he'd been going for a couple of years. And he had intervened in all sorts of political events and political processes, and one of them was, of course, the civil rights movement. And I'm not a bobcat, but I've been a fan of Bob Dylan for now just getting on for 50 years.
I'm your masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud.
The curious thing about that song is that it's basically one chord. It's almost like a drone.
Yes, and his voice drones on. Oh, he does raise it occasionally, yeah.
That was Bob Dylan's Masters of War, recorded in 1963. Paul Cartledge, your work has taken in the whole of the ancient Greek civilization, but Sparta is your speciality. And I wonder what drew you to Sparta rather than any of the many other Greek states.
When people say you're a Spartophile or Laconophile, it's not quite true because I abhor an awful lot about their society, and in particular the fact that their culture was based on the exploitation of many more Greeks who were unfree, and they're known as Helots. But for the Helots and their exploitation by the Spartans could not have lived the way they did. Now, the Spartans made the choice, and they chose to live a military lifestyle. However, oddly, it was punctuated regularly by music, and some of the earliest musicians. They're not Spartans necessarily, but they went to Sparta. And the Spartans, partly it was for practice. I mean, in the very hottest, one of the hottest parts of Greece, they danced vigorously, military dances and other forms. And Spartan dances were known as, that is, a Spartan dance. And the Spartans loved choral music. The Greek word choros means originally dance. It only secondarily means you sing as well as you dance, so it means a singing chorus.
Well, you have managed to find for us what we think, I think that's the best way of putting, choral music might have sounded like. A choral version of a first Delphic hymn to Apollo.
Yes.
So this is 2nd century BC. So yes. It must be really quite probably one of the earliest pieces we've ever had on the programme.
Well, the notation is dated, and so you can say it's actually either 148 or 138 BC or BCE. And this particular version, the setting, is done by a man called Gregorio Paniagua. And it's a choral, as you say, version. And one assumes that the original was indeed choral because it is a hymn.
The first Delphic hymn to Apollo, performed by Atrium Music of Madrid. Of course, our word music comes from the Greek, and choreography is also a Greek word, and it's also a passion of yours, ballet, I know. So we're now going to bring an awful lot of things very comfortably together, because Stravinsky wrote a marvellous ballet score, which Balanchine choreographed wonderfully well, and it's on the theme of Apollo, Stravinsky's Apollo and Zajet. I'm not surprised, and I'm hugely delighted that you've chosen this.
As you say, it brings together an awful lot. I'm a great fan of the Ballet Russe in general, of Diaghilev's ability to commission, to command the services of a stunning array of composers, painters, designers, choreographers, just extraordinary for about 2 decades. And this is right at the end of Diaghilev. Diaghilev died the year after, in 1929. And he is the refounder, really, of modern classical ballet, neoclassical ballet, if you like. And this is his first hit.
Simon Rattle conducting the strings of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra in the prologue to Stravinsky's ballet Apollo, Apollon Musagette. And you can find details of all Paul Cartledge's music on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Of course, Stravinsky went on, Paul, didn't he, to write a cantata on the Oedipus myth. And there are a huge number of pieces that have been inspired by Greek mythology, from the Baroque to today. And one thinks quite recently of Julian Anderson's Sophocles,
Theban.
Tippett's King Priam,
yeah.
Strauss's Electra, and Burke was most of his operas.
Minotaur and Son.
Yeah, Orpheus.
Theseus, yeah. Theseus.
Why do you think it is that composers find this such a wonderfully profitable mine?
Well, it's partly because there are so many wonderful myths. I mean, just the storylines and the ancients themselves regarded myths as very plastic. And opera in the 16th and early 17th century is thought to have been invented partly as a kind of modern reinvention of tragedy, ancient Greek theatre. So there is not just an accidental link, but actually it's built into the very tradition of music making that the ancient Greeks are our ancestors. One of the points of my engagement with the ancient Greeks is to get across this odd combination. They were very different, and yet they can still inspire us, e.g. through opera and ballet.
Well, we're going to hear Mozart now. Actually, curiously, it's not an opera that we hear very often, because it's unfinished. But it produced one aria that's an absolute corker, didn't it?
Taida, as it's called. I have actually got a vinyl recording of it. But the reason I've chosen this particular recording is for the singer, actually, Inger Dam Jensen, who won the Cardiff Singer of the World in 1993. But she sang some Mozart as her final performance choice. And I've always been fond of her. And the opera is one of these Orientalist fantasies, and we're talking about the Ottoman Empire. And, of course, Mozart, born in Vienna in the mid-18th century, was, what, three generations? I think sort of his great-grandparents would have been threatened by sultans from Constantinople in the 1680s. So it's not for them as remote and as sort of foreign as it would be for us a couple of centuries later. But here the singer is imagining, she's trying to comfort her boyfriend, as it were, who's captured by this terrible sultan. And she tells him when he wakes up, he will see a portrait of her. My wife's maiden name is Portrait, her professional name, so it has that little resonance for me as well.
Thank you.
Inga Dam Jensen singing the title role in the aria Ruhe Sanft, Rest Peacefully, from Mozart's unfinished opera Zaid. Nicholas McGuigan was conducting the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden. Paul Cartledge, your new book is called Democracy, A Life, and I wonder what you feel we can learn from Greek democracy and what they might make of our version of it.
Yes, the puzzle is why we call our system democracy, because in its original signification, democracy meant something more like dictatorship of the proletariat. But you and I, ordinary people, we're voters, but we don't rule. We choose people to rule for us, so we delegate power to representatives who are supposed to represent our interests. But we can call them to account, but only occasionally. One of the key elements of ancient democracy was that any leader could be called to account almost at any moment. So they had to be very careful. There were no governments in antiquity. There were no parties in antiquity. There are all sorts of things which I'm sometimes asked, if I was to introduce a form of democracy today, what would it be like? Well, it wouldn't have parties in it for a start.
Now, another piece led by a particular musician, which is important for you, and that's Claudio Abbado. Mm. It's Rossini's The Journey to Reims. Of course, Abbado died at the beginning of 2014, a wonderful conductor.
Yeah.
And what made you choose this particular piece?
Well, it's one of those that, as you say, the first time you see it, the impact is immense. I'm a huge fan of Rossini in general, both his more serious and his comic operas, and this is one of them. But it's serio-comic. It's called a drama giocoso, a humorous drama. And the scenario is the coronation of Charles X of France, succeeding his brother. And Rossini wasn't the only one who was inspired by this event. He happened to have just become the musical director of the Italian theatre in Paris, and he chose this scenario of a group of international European travellers who wish to get to the coronation, but unfortunately they don't get as far as Reims. They get as far as a place called Palombière, and they hole up at an inn called the Golden Lily, and the innkeeper and her guests, of whom there are 13 or 14, are then caught because they're waiting for horses to take them on for the last stage to Reims, and they don't turn up. And so what are they going to do? Well, they entertain themselves culturally by talking to each other about their different traditions, and actually it ends up with a number of them singing versions of their own national anthem. So you've got the Austrian antiquary, Don Profondo, and he's given by Rossini, or rather by his librettist, an extraordinary patter aria where he goes through the distinctive features of the luggage of, there's a French man and a French woman, and then a Spanish man, a German man, and the Englishman, who of course has tea from China, and he's got pistols. And the one that most struck me, because it I suppose appealed to me because of its content, is what's called the medallions that are incomparable.
Comparabili, carrera impagabili, fili tenebrosa, sublime antichità, in aura carta pecora dell'Accademia e titoli, onde son membro nobile di prima qualità, di gran trattati inedito sull'infallibile metodo, di saper ben distinguere a prima vista ignor, l'antico dal moderno, l'interno dall'esterno, nei maschi delle femmine più di alto gentilcore. Lo spagnolo. Grandiate che neologhe che degli avoli bisavoli con le nazista storie che di qualche neono fu di pochi stemmi e croci nastri con lane d'ordini e grosse come doci sei sperma stessa lì la polacca l'opera più squisita in autori prelibati per mantosse la gloria della modernità disegni colorati dell'atto più terribile da Roma convinciva il verbo di questa la facile scatole, scatoline, coschini e cassettini, che pentesimo nascondo in un sacchiele di d'amor. Guardate il nuovo fragile, più chiuso sta indovino, il nuovo cappellino con la strimba vietior. Il tetesco,
dissertazioni classiche sui nuovi effetti armonici, onnipotenti afonici e ritesterà il suo corpo, i nuovi effetti tonici, le rare produzioni, i coni di tromboni, il modellino di amboni. L'inglese. Piacciti c'è una globo, c'è sette di Moraine, ho l'unico della China, sotto il cuore c'è c'è. Ho mio pistola vento, cambiali come il toro, e beh che parlamento, c'è volte legge prego. E qua c'è. Varie dei pancorazzi, litografi squisite, bene li combattite, con chi dei due colori, sono così sacra intendo, ritratti di dettini, con molti ricordini dei suoi felici amori. Russo! Notiste tipografiche di tuote la Siberia, cantici ufiliatiche dell'Ottoman Impero, gesti bellini e muerte le preziose collezioni, con penne di caponi e nastre per cimie, gesti bellini e muerte le preziose collezioni, con penne di caponi e nastre per cimie, e per cimie, e per cimie. Sta tutto all'ordine? Non me che dire. Devo partire, si può andare. Con il piano, siete tornato. Desde gli arrobini, desde i frementi. Già voglio vivere, con gli ossi di e sempre i corridenti, per controllare. Per questo istante, si trova un parco di fare, parco di fare.
Ruggero Raimondi as Don Profondo, a scholar of antiquities, in his Act III aria from Rossini's opera The Journey to Reims, Claudio Abbado conducting the Berlin Philharmonic. So back now to our scholar of antiquities, Paul Cartledge. You've been very keen, I know, to be an advocate for taking studies and ideas from these ancient civilizations to a wider audience, and actually have advised on certain films, one of which created a bit of controversy, didn't it?
I was afraid you might mention that. The 300, it's called 300. It was a remake of 1962, The 300 Spartans, and it was done as a kind of cartoon. But the controversy it generated was because the original cartoon book, the graphic novel on which the movie was based, was in its way already, one might almost say racist. I mean, one might say ethnocentric. And the Iranian embassy to the United Nations in New York lodged a formal protest. I feel ambivalent about the film. I advised on pronunciation. How do you pronounce Leonidas? And so I said, well, it could be Leonidas, that's the English way, or it could be Leonidas, which is the modern Greek way, or it could be Leonidas, and you'll never guess which one they went for. Leonidas it is.
Well, Leonidas Kavakos is a wonderful violinist. Oh, I don't know if you've come across
yes,
him.
Of huge fan. Anybody whose name ends in Arkos, it means that they're originally from the Peloponnese. So I'm particularly keen on him.
Well, to finish, Paul Cartledge, you've chosen Yo-Yo Ma with the Cleveland Quartet playing one of the most sublime creations in music.
Yeah. Well, Schubert I discovered terribly late with the bicentenary of his birth in 1997. I hadn't really appreciated just what an extraordinary talent he was, nor had I appreciated how much of his work that's really, really seriously great was written very near the end of his very short life. He lived only 31 years or so. Nor had I known that he had been a pallbearer at Beethoven's funeral and stuff like that. I knew very little when I first heard him. And of all that I heard, the reason I've selected this is because I happened upon this particular recording. It was in a remainder box in, I think, Tower Records at Piccadilly Circus. And the performers were all performing on Strads, and the sound, I had never heard anything like it, and this particular bit of Schubert is relatively sad, but Schubert can be joyful as well, and I have gained great pleasure and great comfort from him over the years.
And it's rather nice to hear the end of this movement, because we quite often hear the famous opening, which is very tentative and fragile. But the ending is absolutely marvellous. So it's a wonderful note to thank you, Paul Cartledge, for sharing it and all of the music with us.
And thank you for inviting me. I've had a ball.
Part of the slow movement of Schubert's String Quintet, performed by the Cleveland Quartet with the cellist Yo-Yo Ma. And that ends this week's Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest was Paul Cartledge, and the programme was produced by Jane Greenwood for Loftus. You can download the programme and many others from the series via the podcasts page of the BBC Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest is the psychiatrist Henrietta Bowden-Jones.
Celebrating Simon Rattle on BBC Radio 3. 20 years ago, Simon Rattle conducted his first ever Beethoven symphony cycle with the orchestra that he led for 18 years, the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. This year, Britain's most iconic conductor is 60, and to mark his birthday, Radio 3 is broadcasting those recordings for the first time, from the pioneering First Symphony through the drama of the Fifth to the joyous Ninth. Join me, Tom Service, for Simon Rattle's first ever recordings of the complete Beethoven symphonies, beginning tomorrow evening at 7:30 and continuing throughout the week, only on BBC Radio 3.
Yes, tomorrow is actually Simon Rattle's 60th birthday, and our celebrations here on Radio 3 begin tonight in Through the Night with me, John Shea, at 12:30, when you've another chance to hear last summer's prom performance of Bach's St. Matthew Passion. That's with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and Mark Padmore as the evangelist. Through the Night tonight at 12:30. That's here on BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. In a couple of minutes, today's lunchtime concert and another chance to hear last Monday's live concert from the Wigmore Hall, violin sonatas by Mozart and Enescu. And then at 2:00, the harpsichordist Sophie Yates is today's presenter of the Early Music Show. She's profiling the French harpsichordist and composer Jacques Dufly, who was born 300 years ago this month. The Early Music Show is in an hour. It's now coming up to 2 minutes past one here on BBC Radio 3, and time for the latest news. There are still delays of several hours to Eurostar services following the fire on a lorry in the Channel Tunnel yesterday. Passenger trains and Eurotunnel services both resumed this morning after being suspended since yesterday lunchtime. Officials say it's because only one of the two tunnels is open and trains are running at slower speeds. The shuttle train carrying the lorry which caught fire is still in the other tunnel, which won't be opened until it's been removed. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, has told British Jews that the government will do everything it can to combat anti-Semitism following the attack on a kosher supermarket in Paris in which four Jewish men were killed. She told members of the Board of Deputies of British Jews that security had been stepped up and that the government would bring forward new proposals to combat extremism and promote inclusive British values. The second of the brothers who killed 12 people at the offices of the magazine Charlie Hebdo in Paris has been given a secret burial. Sherif Kouachi's coffin was placed in an unmarked grave just before midnight in the Paris suburb where he lived. Local officials said his widow and other relatives stayed away. The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, has told the BBC he would not sit in a cabinet with the UKIP leader, Nigel Farage. He also said he would find it difficult to imagine circumstances in which he would be alongside the SNP in a coalition cabinet after the general election in May. Mr Clegg said his party did not intend to increase income tax or VAT to cut the deficit if it remained in power. He said he was absolutely confident that neither measure would be necessary. He said his party would want to impose further tax increases on the wealthiest in society. In the Philippines, several million people have joined Pope Francis to celebrate Mass in a park in Manila. It's thought to be the largest papal gathering since Pope John Paul II visited the same venue, Rizal Park, 20 years ago. And the weather. Sunny spells in most areas this afternoon, but some northern parts, mainly on the coast, will experience wintry showers. It'll be dry but very cold across the country tonight. And that's the news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:04. So now time for the Radio 3 lunchtime concert and a second chance to hear last Monday's live broadcast, which was introduced by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to Wigmore Hall in central London. It's a very windy day in the UK today, and we can expect a gale force performance here in today's lunchtime concert from Patricia Kopaczynskaya, a wild child of the violin, one of the most dynamic musicians performing today. Her playing is often described as folksy. She has her own musical roots in Moldovan folk music, which her parents both played for a living. And in the second piece in her lunchtime recital today, we're going to hear that background coming through as she plays George Enescu's third violin sonata, inspired by his own childhood immersed in the sound of gypsy fiddlers. Well, Patricia Kopaczynskaya and the pianist she's here with, Russian-born Polina Leshenko, are starting their concert with a Mozart sonata in B-flat, Köchel 454. Mozart wrote it for the violinist Regina Stranaski in Vienna. Well, when I say wrote, he wrote the violin part, but the piano part he basically made up himself as he went along in performance, apparently playing from a blank sheet of paper, which the emperor noticed and called him backstage about afterwards. So here to start their recital with Mozart's violin sonata in B-flat are the violinist Patricia Kopaczynskaya and pianist Polina Leshenko.
Thank you.